Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're right in the middle of audio open lines talking about Hell House's Judgment Houses, and I want to know what you think about those during audio open lines coming up in a half hour. We'll talk about the wife of Martin Luther, Katie Luther. Dr. Martin Noland will join us here in the studio. We'll review a sermon by Pastor Will Wheaton, a Reformation Day sermon, perhaps different from the kind of Reformation Day sermon you may have heard in your church, based on John 8, if the sun sets you free, you will be free indeed. And then, right after that review of the sermon by Pastor Will Wheaton, a little bit more open lines. I want to know from you on this Reformation Day, is the Reformation over? Do we need another one, as so many think we do? And we'll talk a little bit about the current state of the Lutheran Reformation. Oh, we're only 5 days away, believe it or not, from the premier worship conference of 2006. It's called the Good Shepherd Institute. It's November the 5th through the 7th on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. We'll be there broadcasting live from the Good Shepherd Institute on Sunday for our nationally syndicated edition of Issues, Etc., and on Monday for our weekday program. And I'm looking forward to seeing you there. For more information on the Good Shepherd Institute, find the logo for the Good Shepherd Institute at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Theological Seminary at area code 260-452-2256, 260-452-2256. Equip yourself in the worship wars by attending the Good Shepherd Institute November 5th through the 7th, at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 260-452-2256, or look at our website for the logo, issuesetc.org. All right, I want to know, do you think the Hell Houses, as you've experienced them or as you're hearing about them here on this program, the Judgment Houses, are effective evangelism? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us, as several have, here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's a few more minutes of this Studio 360 story on the Brooklyn Hell House being put on by a secular theater group.
With the arrival of Hell House in Brooklyn, Pastor Keenan's gospel message is thrown that much wider, no matter it may be falling in unfriendly waters. When he proclaims Hell House is about truth and love, he's wrapped in the armor of God. Here's Professor Ballmer again.
What I worry about theologically with a production like Hell House is that it's not really good news. I think it's theologically suspect from within the confines of evangelical theology.
Toward the finale of Hell House is a hallway of horrors, a staple of any haunted house worth its salt. It's a very narrow, winding corridor each person must walk through, while ghosts and ghouls leap out from behind corners. In Hell House, Alex Timbers finds this particularly effective.
They aren't ghosts and ghouls. They're people you know who are dying of AIDS, who have decided to have abortions. And I find it exceptionally powerful in the Brooklyn version of that, that these people that I know as a metropolitan liberal who are deeply suffering, which makes me very sad, they're depicted as people who deserve to go to hell, as people who are to be hated and despised.
There's probably many in the New York theater-going crowd, they've already made up their minds before they see it. That really doesn't matter, because you're still giving it access. You may not like what I'm saying, but you are listening.
For Studio 360, I'm Peter Crimmins.
Well, the big question is, what is he saying? What is the author of Hell House saying through his scripts that get proliferated across the country to many evangelical churches and the play gets put on? I guess it is a play. It comes with a kit and a script and all the things you need, instructions on how to put on your own Judgment House or Hell House. What is it saying? Yes, people are listening. The question is, it's not good enough just to have people listening. I can get people to listen. I can get people to pay attention to anything. Once you have their attention, what do you say? Do you simply point out the horrors of sin, which is altogether true, and that sin destroys? Or do you actually give them what only Christians, you know, other people could say abortion's bad for other reasons, or that same-sex marriage is bad for other reasons. You don't even really have to believe it's a sin, necessarily, to say it's a bad thing. Right? I mean, there are a lot of people who are opposed to same-sex marriage or abortion, not on moral grounds per se, but because they think it's bad for society or there are better alternatives. The only distinctly Christian message that we have is not necessarily a condemnation of sin. That's not distinct to Christianity. The only distinctly Christian message we have is the one who did not sin and lived a sinless life for us in our place as our substitute, all the way to the cross, to his death and his resurrection for us. So what do you think about judgment houses or hell houses? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk with Gary, who's calling from his car. Hi, Gary.
Oh, good afternoon, Todd.
Hi.
I've never been in one of these places, but to me it just sounds like they're taking the low road, for one thing, and I think it just fits along the lines of, you know, Finney's new measures, where they're just trying to manufacture a response. Of course, that's the same thing that most evangelicals see every Sunday anyway, is an attempt to manufacture some kind of response. And I think maybe if they, talking along the more subtle sins, they ought to have a room where they walk in and it looks like a congregation singing their happy hand-clapping songs but never hear the gospel.
That scares me. Thank you, Gary. Yeah, that's scarier to me, actually, tell you the truth. What's scarier? A person who commits a sin, no matter how heinous, and then, as Scripture says, repents and hears the gospel, the real gospel, not just, by the way, as they're driving away, Jesus saves. What's scarier, that or a church that under the guise of preaching the gospel never actually gets to the cross Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, that believes that that gospel doesn't really, they have to, as Gary said, manufacture a response. That gospel is not capable of creating faith itself. You got to create the right conditions. You got to manipulate people emotionally. You have to ape the culture. Is the church so bereft of ideas that we have to say, hey, haunted house, kids like it, let's do that. But we'll kind of Christianize it, so we'll, instead of having the horrors be Dracula and the Wolfman or Freddy Krueger, we'll have the horrors be abortion and Columbine, rock and roll music, and... not rock and roll music, because we're doing that in church, right? Heavy metal music, that's right, and gay marriage. You could scare people. Are we so bereft of ideas that we... And so lack so much confidence in the actual preaching of law and gospel that we think we actually have to manufacture that response? Do we trust the gospel to be the power of God unto salvation, or don't we? Because if we don't, Paul says in that famous passage I just made reference to, if we don't trust the gospel to be the power of God unto salvation, then we're ashamed of it. Oh, speaking of Charles Finney, Sunday night, live from the Good Shepherd Institute at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, we're going to discuss American revivalism and those new measures of Charles Finney, and how much would we have a hell house if we didn't have Charles Finney? I think Charles Finney would have been all for a hell house. Whatever gets a response. And really that response doesn't make much difference as long as it's something. We're going to be talking about that Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis with Dr. Larry Rast, American Revivalism, and the father of American Revivalism, Charles Grandison Finney. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, audio open lines, issues, etc. This Tuesday, the 31st of October, Paul's calling from his car. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just wanted to comment back again with the other caller. And add some of my own. I think we're so caught up in the everything that's going on that's wrong, and that we want to point it out, we forget to point the finger at ourselves and realize that the cross was there because of us as well. And the cross is, as I say when I teach Sunday school, is central, and that's the only thing that matters when it gets down to it.
And Paul, yeah, I think you're right, because when they depict sin as the big ticket items, I agree with you, then I can walk through the hell house, and because I am not engaged to a man or getting married to a man, I'm a heterosexual. I haven't had an abortion. I did not in high school kill my fellow classmates or really for very long listen to heavy metal music. Then I'm okay. Jesus didn't need to die for me. And it lets me off the hook for my thoughts, my words, and my deeds, which don't seem to measure up to the big ticket items. Steve writes this via the email. Is the hell house proclaiming the gospel or the law? Basic fundamental question. You're right, Steve. But where is the greatest horror of all history? God the Son, bloody and dead on the cross. This is no different than that of the left behind view where we can scare people into accepting Jesus as Savior. Thanks, Steve. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Remember what I said a few minutes ago? The devil doesn't care whether you're secure in your sin or despairing in your sin, as long as you're in your sin. He doesn't care whether you are a happy sinner or a scared sinner, as long as you are a sinner without Jesus. And a hell house without Jesus produces either happy sinners who say, I haven't committed Columbine, abortion, or gay marriage, I'm a happy sinner, or despairing sinners who've done one of those three things or whatever else is mentioned there, and they're despairing, but without Jesus, they're still a sinner without Jesus. 505-7850-1800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Eric in Olathe, Kansas, writes, from what I've heard of these judgment houses, they don't nearly do justice to hell. The hell the Bible speaks of is incomprehensible to me. Never mind the eternal torment, dark yet full of fire. I can't even get my mind around the idea of eternal separation from God. In light of that viewpoint, I'd have to agree with an earlier caller who said it's just Halloween stuff. I also appreciate the point about Satan not generally operating with fear, but with doubt. He's the conniving, reasoning, nitpicking voice, rationalizing everything I know I shouldn't do. I know people criticizing C.S. Lewis for the petty behavior of his Wormwood, but I think he nailed it as far as Satan's true nature goes. Thank you very much, Eric. Yeah, Satan comes, parades around as an angel of light. The very nature of Satan's activity among us is that we think. It's not Satan, but it's God. Oh, we don't stop to ask, am I doing the right thing? Because Satan is a deceiver. See, here's the picture. You walk into Hell House, and there's a guy dressed as a devil. If the devil dressed as a devil, he wouldn't deceive anybody. If he stood out at the door saying, come in, my pretties, and wiggling his tongue at you like Gene Simmons, you'd pretty much get the picture that this is a guy you don't want to spend much time with. But Scripture says, no, he's an angel of light. That's what makes him dangerous. Talk about dangerous, and talk about another gospel that isn't a gospel. Here's a CNN story on the so-called prosperity gospel in the form of one Creflo dollar.
Sunday morning. The sun has just risen, and already thousands are streaming into a giant church south of Atlanta to hear this pastor talk about blessings, God, and money. Yes, money. He's not shy about it.
The Word of God is the gateway to the world of wealth.
Pastor Creflo Dollar, Dollar is his real name, has been growing his church for 20 years. He claims it has 29,000 members, which ranks it among the largest Christian churches in the United States. Pastor Dollar preaches what's often referred to as a gospel of prosperity.
Let's say you have a pie and divide it up into slices. You've got the faith slice, the deliverance slice, the healing slice, and the financial slice. Now, That whole pie is called prosperity.
He says the secret to that prosperity is in the Bible. To be prosperous, he says, all you have to do is read it, understand it, and live it. Among the believers are Rick and Norma Hayes. They are in the front row, just seats away from another follower, Evander Holyfield.
I can think of one scripture in particular, in Psalms 112, which says, wealth and riches shall be in my house.
Like others, the Hayes believe material wealth is just part of the prosperity God blesses on those who follow his word. Rick says he was homeless just before he entered the church 14 years ago. Now he's a successful salesman. He has a nice home, income, and expensive cars. According to Time magazine, 61% of Christian Americans believe God wants people to be financially prosperous. It's all part of a trend led by pastors like Dollar and Joel Osteen, whose Houston area church, with its similar message, is the largest in the United States. Dollar's teachings are a bit controversial. Among other things, critics say it ignores one of the Bible's central themes, the suffering of Christ.
There's this Jesus who died for us so we can have a type of life that experiences peace and prosperity.
What's more, he says poverty is a curse and that poor people can find prosperity if they believe. The Reverend Dr. James Forbes is the senior minister at Riverside Church in New York. He sees some positive things in the prosperity movement, but has concerns.
I do think that extraordinary luxury begins to undercut the authenticity of the message of God's care for all of us.
Dollar and his followers say they use their financial success to help the poor and their church. Tithing or donating is a central part of the church's belief.
Well, it's opportunity for prosperity.
Dollar believes it's required by the Bible and that God gives back to the true believers who put in. And from the looks of the parking lot, it seems to be working. Delia Gallagher, CNN, Atlanta.
All right, there's the story on Creflo Dollar. It's odd that we get a story like that from CNN on his prosperity gospel, which he is... First, I'll say something positive about Creflo Dollar. He's an honest man. He's completely and utterly honest. He's not pulling the old switcheroo like we just recently had Marilyn Hickey on. And in the past, she probably would have sounded more like Creflo Dollar than she did when we interviewed her. But now in the present, she sounds more like Joel Osteen. Pulling the old switcheroo, they still have the prosperity gospel, but they have softened it down so much that you can hardly tell it's there. You know the problem with this? Now I'm done saying positive things about Creflo Dollar. The positive, the problem with the prosperity gospel is not only that it is another gospel, it is, but how is it another gospel? It's another gospel the way every single other gospel, every single alternative to the true gospel is. Whether it's a Roman Catholic saying it's Jesus plus your works save you, Jesus becomes a means to an end. Jesus' life, death, and resurrection for sinners becomes a means to an end. He only did that so that you could, in the case of the Roman Catholics, do that which is in you and in one form or another earn your way into God's favor. Or, if you're Creflo Dollar, Jesus lived and died and rose again for you as a means to an end so that you can be prosperous. Or, in his case, exercise your faith, give enough at church so that then God can return it all to you. But Jesus then becomes a very small element. He's just the catalyst that gets the real stuff going. But it's really no different from what's being taught in a lot of Christian churches. They don't deny that Jesus died for sinners. They just present it as a means to an end. Jesus died for sinners so that you could find your purpose, earn heavenly rewards, live the American dream, balance your checkbook, be a good husband. Jesus becomes a means to an end rather than the end in himself. Okay, we got time for one final piece. Here on Audio Open Lines, here's the latest on Darfur, the crisis there in that region of Sudan, from CNN.
The embattled United Nations envoy defended his public critique of the Sudanese government, saying they continue to violate the Darfur peace agreement they signed.
That my incessant criticism on this was a reason for them to silence me.
The man who spent several years shuttling among government and rebel groups in Darfur said he'd convinced the rebels to stop attacking the government, telling them government militias and the Janjaweed are ruthless.
If you steal camels, they kill in retaliation babies. And I said to the rebels, this is going out of control.
But more bombing by the government and arming of militias, he says, have led him to one conclusion. The Sudanese government still wants a military solution to the problem of Darfur.
The rebel movements have promised me, after many discussions, really to stop attacking the government. However, the government has continued to attack.
The Sudanese government recently went on the attack against Pronk after his personal blog accused the Sudanese army of arming militias. The government kicked him out of Sudan and accused him of lying and losing his impartiality.
For us, Mr. Pronk is history.
In the end, a hedged decision from the United Nations. Pronk will leave after his contract expires at the end of this year. But before that, he will return briefly to Sudan for a handover to his successor.
Only the Secretary General has the authority to change the tenure of one of his personal special representatives. But obviously, at a critical time in the situation in the Sudan, we need to preserve a good working relationship with the government of Sudan.
After their meeting with Pronk, diplomats kept any grumbling behind closed doors.
Yes, that frankness, that outspokenness, is something that can come only from a man with deep conviction and commitment.
The problems of Sudan have spilled beyond its borders. There are concerns about tensions with neighboring Chad and the Central African Republic. There are fears that the already poor security in Chad's refugee camps, packed with mostly women and children, will collapse if there are new waves of refugees. So a UN mission will go to those countries to see if troops could be put in place. The UN envoy to the Sudan had parting words for the gathered diplomats. Stay alert, he said, and don't forget the people of Sudan. They are counting on you. Liz Nieslas, CNN, United Nations.
Those are some good words, by the way. Don't forget the people in the Sudan, especially that region of the Darfur, and those who are fleeing the country because of religious oppression, because of a civil war that continues to rage out of control, and they're now finding the way into all sorts of other African countries, and they are there because they are in need. LCMS World Relief is on the front lines in the Sudan. To find out how you can help their efforts, look for the LCMS World Relief logo at our homepage. It's issuesetc.org, or you can earmark a donation for the Sudan by calling them toll-free 1-888-930-4438. It's the number for LCMS World Relief, 1-888-930-4438. When we come back from this break, Dr. Martin Nolan joins us here in Studio A. We're going to talk about, on this Reformation Day, not Luther, but Luther's better half. I think he probably would have affirmed that Katie was the better half of that lineup. And then we'll be reviewing a sermon, a Reformation Day sermon by Pastor Will Wheaton, based on John chapter 8, beginning at verse 31. And we'll have open lines for you in the last half hour. Is the Reformation over? And the current state of the Lutheran Reformation.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. guest, Dr. Arthur Jest on the Good Shepherd Institute, November 5th through 7th, on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We are dedicated to hearing and discerning the clear voice of Jesus, the Good Shepherd, through our attention to the preaching, the historic liturgies, the catechesis, and the hymns of the church that communicate Christ. We hold a yearly conference during All Saints weekend in which we explore these things. We're particularly interested in serving congregations and parishes, parish pastors, musicians, and other church workers, and also helping the laity to come to love and appreciate the treasures of our Lutheran faith and our Lutheran liturgy and our Lutheran life.
Join Issues Etc. as we broadcast live from the Good Shepherd Institute, November 5th through 7th, at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, look for the Good Shepherd Institute logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. A federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit against the Air Force Academy. Former cadet Mikey Weinstein and four classmates were suing the academy, claiming there was evangelical bias on campus. Steve Jordahl reports the court affirmed the right of government employees to share their personal faith, but a threat remains.
The court found that none of the former cadets personally experienced the alleged bias and dismissed the suit. Ted Haggard of the National Association of Evangelicals says the decision could have been a historic setback for freedom of religion.
If the judge would have gone the opposite direction, then that would have been the first time in American history that we would have had to have developed a protocol in the government to establish religion.
Liberty Legal Institute lawyer Hiram Sasser says this case is symptomatic of so many religious expression cases brought to the courts.
This opinion really sheds light on that these Establishment Clause cases, that these are really bogus claims, because no one is harmed by somebody in passing making a religious reference.
The judge dismissed the suit without prejudice, which leaves the door open for another go. And Mikey Weinstein says they will file with a vengeance.
We'll be back with hammer and tongs, and you know we intend to lay down a withering field of fire and kick butt, leave sucking chest wounds, and you know restore the Constitution in this heart of diminutive Christian evangelical darkness.
Sasser says the battle should be joined.
There's nothing in the Constitution that requires you to suppress your religious beliefs because you put on a uniform or because you are employed by the government.
Round two is coming up, and it sounds like it's getting personal. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Both the Air Force and Navy instituted new regulations on how chaplains were permitted to pray after Weinstein filed his suit. Congress subsequently voided those regulations. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. Specialty Equipment Market Association has a show which highlights what we consumers demand from our vehicles on our dashes in terms of technology and infotainment. Nancy Philippart of General Motors will be our guest on the next Living Jubilee to talk about that.
It is true that the doctrine of the Trinity is something of a mystery, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't teach it to our young children. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is titled The Apostles' Creed. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're halfway through the program today, coming to you live this Tuesday, the 31st of October. And since the 31st of October is not only Halloween, it is also the Eve of All Saints Day, upon which, about 500 years ago, Martin Luther decided to post the 95 Theses. It's recognized also as Reformation Day. Now, when Martin Luther posted those 95 Theses, he was a young man, and he was also a single man, and he remained single for quite some time. But after some time, he married, and he married a woman, Katrina von Bora. We're going to be talking about her, Katie Luther, during this half hour of Issues, etc. Dr. Martin Nolan has been kind enough to come down the street from the Concordia Historical Institute, where he serves as director, and join us here in Studio A. Marty, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
First to Luther and then to Katie. Can we detect a difference, looking at Luther in what he wrote and what is said of him, pre-Katie as opposed to post-Katie?
I think that Luther has a better sense of humor after Katie. His contemporaries would say that Luther was a happier man and that he was in better health. And the reason for that is that Katerina, when she was in the monastery or the nunnery, she was a very hard worker in a lot of different areas. And so when she became Luther's wife, she was very good at keeping house and cooking and all the things that, you know, provide for the means of this life. And before that, he had probably had some servant help, but nobody really took care of Luther personally. And she was also a nurse, say an amateur nurse. And so any time that he got sick, which after he got married, not because of her, but because he was starting to get older, she was able to treat these with apothecary type of medications. And most scholars say that he would not lasted. Certainly she added 10 years to his life.
There's a famous quote that I paraphrase from Luther where he talks about, you know, before Katie, I would work myself to the bone. I would fall into bed each night into dirty sheets in a flop sweat. And then after Katie came along, Katie kept house, he simply said. So it sounds as though Luther's life not only was lengthened, but in many ways eased by marriage and by marriage to Katie.
There's no doubt about that. And I think that the table talk was also, I mean, I'm sure he went out for a beer with the guys. You know, that's a university thing to do, and the faculty do that with the students as much as the students with each other. But the setting up of the Luther home as a place where people could convive, you know, around here on campus they have this thing called Stammtisch. I don't know who's the sponsor of that, but he's probably listening. But the whole idea is it's a regular time of gathering, and in English we say you shoot the bull. You know, you talk about all sorts of subjects. And, well, somebody's got to be in the background putting on the beer and cleaning things up, and that's what Katie did. And so that opportunity, the Stammtisch, the table opportunities for just discussions with peers, I think that might not have happened, certainly not the degree that it did, without Katie's work.
Give us a little biography of Katie Luther up to the point where she and Luther meet and eventually, at long last, marry.
Well, Caterina was born on January 29th in 1499, so she is about, what would that be, 16 years younger than Luther. Her homeland was Hirschfeld, which is 15 miles west of Dresden. So we're talking about, you know, standard Saxony. It's in the district of Meissen. People may know about the Meissen porcelain. And her father was Hans von Bora. He was a member of the German Knights. He was a gentleman farmer of a small feudal estate. And when Anna's mother died, or Katerina's mother died, her name was Anna, then he remarried and he got rid of Katerina by sending to a monastery or a nunnery.
That was very common, wasn't it?
It was very common. If you had too many children, or if you just wanted to leave your estate to one, then you sent him to the nunnery of the monastery. And this is what happened to Katerina. And then later, whenever she got out of the monastery with Luther's help, she went back to her father and said, "Will you take me in?" And he said, "No." Actually, I think Luther or a advocate said, and he absolutely refused. So he didn't want anything to do. So it's not just a legal separation that happens between her father and herself, but also, I'm sure, an emotional separation. And so she probably always lived with that the rest of her life, and it was probably very difficult to live with.
She was a Cistercian nun, and what would life, in brief, what would life have been like for her during her days as a nun?
The life of a nun, and we assume that she was typical, centered around worship or corporate prayer, with matins starting at 1 o'clock a.m. That's an ungodly hour, if you ask me, and then seven other services during the day. And then filled in the rest of the time with work, a variety of sorts, cleaning, making things for sale, any sort of number of things, usually gardening, which is support with food. And we know that she had an excellent reputation for her work and her piety and behavior. So she was, what you could say, a model nun. And then the escape happens because somehow, and we don't know how, one of the letters of Luther, or rather his treatise on the judgment of Luther and monastic vows in 1521, gets into that monastery. And the ladies read it and they agree with it. Because, you know, they they are in worship and they hear the Bible, and she was literate. And so they said, you know, this makes sense. And they were ready to go. And then that's how it all happened. It was because of his own writing that they wanted to leave.
Tell us a little bit about that escape and answer this. If she had been caught in her escape from the convent after fleeing, what might have happened to her?
It would not have been a pleasant experience. I'm sure she would have been under discipline. The worst risk that she was taking was that she wouldn't go back to the monastery and there would be nobody to provide for her because, as became clear, her father was not willing to take her back. And she had skills available as a to work in a nunnery, but not otherwise. And she, in that society, she could easily starve to death or by exposure or something like this. So this then Luther then suddenly realizes that he has the bodily welfare of these nuns. He's responsible because he told these people to leave, and now they're in his front doorstep. And so then he arranges in every other case for their marriage, and then he's still left with this one nun, that's Katharina, that he can't set up.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on Katie Luther or her husband Martin, give us a call now, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio, issues@kfuo.org. There's a bit of a legend about how the escape from the convent took place, that the nuns hid themselves in wine barrels or pickle barrels or something, and then were shuffled off to Wittenberg. How close is that to what really happened, as far as we can tell?
The real story on that, as far as historians can tell, is that the nuns escaped with a friend of Luther, who was named, he was a regular merchant in the nunnery. His name was Leonard Coppi, or Coppa, who was a merchant in Torgau. And it was a covered wagon, so you can envision, Americans think of a Conestoga wagon, but it's the same idea. So there's canvas over the wagon, over the load, that is. And in the load were barrels of herring. It is not true, as far as we can tell, that the nuns actually went inside the barrels. There would be a lot of reasons that you wouldn't want to do that. And the covering of the canvas or cloth over the covered wagon would have been sufficient. And he would not have been noticed because he was the regular guy. I mean, he was the guy that came every week to drop things off and pick them up, and why would they suspect him? So that is most likely the true story. And so they didn't come out smelling like fish. Although they were close enough, maybe they did smell a little bit like fish.
So Luther has a sense of responsibility about these women who have escaped from the nunnery or from the convent. They've escaped because they paid attention to what he had written in Critique of Monastic Vows. That would have been the vows that they were under. How do Luther and Katie eventually end up as husband and wife?
Well, as I said, her parents, that is her father and her mother, her stepmother, refused to take Katharina back. So, as I said, Luther had made arrangements for others, and one of the immediate arrangement for Katharina was that she roomed with one family. That didn't work out. So the Chronics, very famous name, the Chronics, this is the Chronic, the Lucas Chronic, the elder, who was for a time the mayor of the town. He also did a lot of artworks, and the Chronic Institute is named after him. So Mr. and Mrs. Chronic took Katharina in, and she worked for them as a maid while Luther was doing everything else and also trying to find a match for her. Now, she was old enough to bear children. At the time, she was 24, but she was considered too old to get married. Now, that sounds really weird to us, but that's the way it was. Luther finally arranged a very good match for her. The councilman in Nuremberg, Jerome Baumgartner, who was about her age, Katharina loved him, and she had a lot of hopes that this would work out. And initially, Jerome told her that, you know, that they were going to be married. Or at least that was the expectation she had. But then Jerome, because it was a long-distance relationship, he was in Nuremberg, she was Wittenberg, he fell in love with a 14-year-old girl. 14 years old, you say? Yes, 14 years old. And so Katerina got one of those Dear John letters, and Luther had to start over again. And so then he tried to arrange her with an old and opinionated professor at Wittenberg named Glatz, and Katerina did not like him and was smart enough not to just simply settle for him. And then one of Luther's associates, Nicholas Amsdorf, came up to Katerina one day and said, "Well, who will you marry? I mean, you know, is there anybody that you're willing to marry?" And she said, "Oh, yes, you, Nicholas, or Martin Luther." And so that's how the word got back to Martin that she was willing to marry him. Didn't say that she was interested, but she was willing to marry him, and only him or Nicholas. And Nicholas wasn't particularly interested at the time. And this initially Luther was against it because he thought that his life would be cut short at any time because he was under the ban, and that meant that anybody could execute him without punishment. But as he thought about it, and especially when he encouraged the Archbishop Albrecht of Mainz to marry, now this is an archbishop, he encouraged, and finally the archbishop did, he began to think about the same arguments that he'd used with the archbishop and apply them to himself. You know, what they say about, you know, drink your own medicine. Well, he did. And so finally then he came to appreciate her qualities and proposed to her, and they married.
So I guess the question that someone maybe more appropriate for Valentine's Day than for...
Yeah, it sounds like Valentine's
Day. Yeah, than for the Reformation Day is... Was this a marriage, as we modern Americans tend to think about, a marriage born of love and romance and courtship? Or was it more or less, well, I have a responsibility for this poor woman, and no one else seems to want her, and she doesn't seem to want the men I'm trying to set her up with, so I guess it falls to me. Can we tell?
It was mostly the latter, but you have to understand that probably 95% of the weddings in those days were the latter. When you use the word courtship, that's very interesting because the idea of romance and dating and all the fancy stuff, that comes out of the courts of Europe. And it started in France. You have to give the French, you know, you have to give them credit for something, you know, besides their food. But they know they invented this whole idea of romance, and it was practiced among the nobility, because the nobility and their children had the time for this sort of thing. But often they are arranged marriages, too, and then that's the whole Romeo and Juliet type of story. But this was really a practical matter. Luther realized that he could get married, it would be good for the gospel and what he was teaching, and here was a lady that needed to be married, and that worked out.
They eventually formed a very strong bond of love
correct.
And affection for one
that's
another.
That's correct. So it was more like some people fall in love before they get married, and over the years they kind of fall out. With Luther and Katie, was kind of the other way. they kind of had their falling out right away because they didn't get along immediately. He was not impressed with her immediately. But over the time, and especially after he got married to her, he much more appreciated her qualities, which served him immensely, probably. He gave the greatest credit to her when he said that if he had the opportunity to receive the city of Venice, which was the richest city and most cultured city of the day, in exchange for Katie, they could keep Venice.
That is saying something.
Yeah, that's saying something.
All right, then let's talk about their life as husband and wife, and in particular as father and mother. They had six children, four of whom survived into adulthood. And what was life like with Katie Luther keeping house around what is called the Luther House and their children there?
The Luther House was more like we would say it was an inn. I don't know if that was the intent of the elector when he granted Luther this property, but that's how it worked out. Especially when Katerina took it over, she realized that she could make money, and she was very good at making money where the opportunity was. She eventually purchased estates or pieces of land and used them for gardens and raising cows and pigs. And this was in addition to the property that was right around the Luther Hall. And she realized that there were rooms that could be used to house students. And before it had been a monastery, so it was a dormitory, basically. It just after Luther had started the Reformation and they weren't monks anymore, well, they wouldn't be living together. So what she did was rent out the rooms to students. And then these people, the students, would then join them for dinner. That would part of their, you know, room and lodging. And then in addition to that, as I said before, the open table, Luther would always invite whoever was in town that was of note. So you have professors, of course, who were his peers. You'd have famous people from all around Europe that were visiting him, other students and family friends, and they would all join together for dinner. So she had a big task every day of cooking up a pretty hefty meal.
And she was really, it sounds like from what you were saying, she was really the one who managed the family, the children, the comers and goers into the house, and the family finances. I heard at one point Luther was just pretty, he's kind of like me, pretty much an idiot when it came to managing his money.
Yeah, this is something maybe the old German farmers need to hear, is that Katie managed the money and the pocketbook. And, because some of these guys, you know, they absolutely refused to let their wives touch any money. But it was just the opposite. Now, partly because Luther was not a businessman. He was a clergyman. He was so heavily wrapped up in his professorships and everything else that he didn't bother with. Even when he was single, he neglected his finances. But she was very turned out because of her experience in managing some of the properties and the books at the nunnery, that she turned out to be a very good business manager. And this is the one thing that we know that they came into conflict, is that Luther had all the time from visitors, he'd get these little gifts. It was the common thing to do, like a little silver cup or a medallion or something like that. And whenever he'd get a visitor, he'd want to give it to, you know, one of these gifts to these people. Well, Katie knew the value of these things, and she wanted to sell them, and he wanted to give it as a gift, and that's where they had a little bit of a conflict. But he didn't always realize the monetary value of these things, and then that's how we know that she was a pretty sharp purchaser, and she knew her business.
Speaking of gifts, I'm wearing it on my finger. You probably may recognize it from that distance, but it's called the Luther wedding ring. My wife and I have had these since, well, now 15 years this year. We gave them to each other for our fifth wedding anniversary. It's a crucifix wrapped around the finger with a little garnet in the center of it. And this is when I was in Wittenberg, had a chance to look at several replicas, and perhaps one of them being the original. Where did that ring come from? Was it really the wedding ring that they gave each other on their wedding day?
Those rings that are in the Lutherhalle in Wittenberg they're either replicas. They're the type that museums produce that are so close that nobody knows except the curator. And probably the original is hidden in a vault in Switzerland someplace. Because, first off, there is some, of course, there's some monetary value, but the historic, they're irreplaceable. So what normally when you have something that's that high value and you can't put it behind a Fort Knox type of security system, you've got a replica.
Did she have it designed for Luther?
That's as far as I know. I don't know a lot about that particular story.
Okay, let's talk about the end of her life. Luther died in 1546, if I'm not mistaken, died of a heart attack while traveling in Eisleben, in his own town. What became of Katie after Luther's death?
Katie had troubles, and that was because under Saxon law, the widow could not own property. The state, that would be the state of Saxony, with its capital in Wittenberg, put her under guardianship, which meant that her affairs financially were governed by Gregory Brooke, the Saxon chancellor, who, by the way, was, I think, both at the Diet of Worms and the Diet of Augsburg. And unfortunately, this chancellor did not like Katharina, and he believed that she did not know how to administer business properties. And so she ended up having to fight for her rights and to use her property the way that she felt that should be done. There was some question about the will, about how the elector, who by that time the two electors were dead, and what they meant when they gave the Luther house to Luther. Was it just to him or was his heirs, as well as some of the estates that they had received? And she basically spent the rest of her life, those 6 years after his death, fighting for her legal and property rights. Now, this was with the help of Melanchthon, and it's important to note that Melanchthon remained personally very loyal to his old friend Luther, and he was one of the few people that really stood up and successfully negotiated for Katerina and her children's rights. So I think that's an important thing to know.
How did she die?
Well, in those years after Luther died, it's what's known as the Smalkaldic Wars, and the emperor was no longer distracted by the Turks, and he thought that the Protestants were in a point of weakness because Luther was gone, so he began attacking Saxony in particular, and actually she had to leave Wittenberg three times because the imperial armies were near, and her friends worried that they might, you know, do some pretty bad things to her because she was a heretic with her husband. And on her last trip out of town in 1552, the wagon she was driving got out of control, and she jumped out of the moving wagon to grab the horses, but fell because it was moving and suffered internal injuries and then died from those in Torgau on December 20th, 1552. Her body is in state in the city church at Torgau under the boys' choir loft, and there's a large memorial slab holding an open Bible, and we had a model of that here at the Institute back in 2004.
Now, speaking of the Institute, before we let you go, what's going on there? I understand you have a new exhibit. I'll give you 30 seconds to tell us what it's about.
Yeah, thank you for that. We have a new exhibit on Ministry to the Armed Forces by Lutheran Chaplains, and this will be up for 2 years. We're open Monday to Friday, 8:30 to 4:30, and it's all about the work of Lutheran chaplains as they serve our boys in the various fields of endeavor. All the four services are included, and also starting from the Civil War up until the present.
And by the way, Lutherans have one of the longest histories of serving as chaplains in the American military.
Yeah, I think that's correct, yes.
So there's a lot of history to be found there.
Right, but ours is just about the Missouri Synod chaplains, but that's certainly very significant too.
Well, for more information on what's going on at the Concordia Historical Institute, including their newest exhibit on military chaplains from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, you can go to their website by going first to ours, issuesetc.org, click links, scroll down, and you'll find a direct link to Martin Noland and the Concordia Historical Institute, or you can call CHI at area code 314-505-7900, 314-505-7900. Dr. Martin Noland is director of the Concordia Historical Institute. Thanks for being our guest this afternoon.
You're welcome.
When we come back from this break, hour three of Issues Etc. straight ahead. We're going to start out with a sermon review. Today, since it is Reformation Day, we'll listen to a Reformation Day sermon that was preached on Sunday by Pastor Will Whedon at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. The sermon is based on John chapter 8, the famous Reformation gospel reading, "If the Son sets you free, you shall be free indeed." And then, when we've concluded our sermon review, on audio open lines, not audio open lines, a little bit of open lines, old-fashioned open lines, I got a question for you. Do you think the Reformation is over, or do we need a new one? And we'll also talk about the current state of the Lutheran Reformation using a resource I often go to. Back in 1998, Lutheran Brotherhood did a survey of Lutherans' beliefs and practices spanning the various Lutheran denominations. 2,200 Lutherans interviewed for this extensive survey. You might be shocked at some of the things you hear Lutherans believe. At least back in 1998, that's only 8 years ago. That's coming up after this break. Open lines, but first a sermon review of a Reformation Day sermon preached by Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. We'll go to John chapter 8, beginning at the 31st verse, right after this.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.